We'll be in James chapter 5 today. We'll be picking up in verse 7 here in just a few minutes. So, one thing from chapter 1. Somebody give me one thing from chapter 1.
Trials,
right? What are we supposed to do with them? All right. Count in all joy and endure, right? There's a positive that comes from that trial. We have to see it from the end goal, not just from this is terrible while being in the midst of it, right? Other things in chapter 1 are the process of sin. We have warnings for the rich. We have looking in that mirror and then going away forgetting who you are. We have being hearers only and not doers, which is unacceptable. Okay, what about chapter 2?
Don't show favoritism.
All right, don't show favoritism, right? And then also we have another major one. What's another major one from chapter 2?
Faith and works.
Faith and works, right? And that statement that faith without works is dead. But as Abraham did, faith was working with his works, and as a result of works, faith was perfected. All right, chapter 3.
The tongue.
Right, the tongue. What about the tongue? Right? It is untamable, and so that means we just not try, right? Right. There should be control that's had there. And that control, I believe, initiates with what is in our heart. Because our mouth is going to say the things that we have put as the bedrock of our mind. What do we believe? What do we think? What is our constant and continual thought? Out of that, our mouth will speak. If we think that our brother is pathetic and less than us, then we'll say those kinds of things. If we view our brother as just as important as we are and a soul that God has given his son for just as he has for us, then our words, I think, will change significantly in the way that we speak about our brother, right? And then at the end of chapter 3, we have kind of our theme for what we're looking at here in James, and what's that? Okay, consulting heavenly wisdom. And that's kind of what we see here on the passage that's on the board. Who among you is wise and understanding? Let him show by his good behavior, his deeds, and the gentleness of wisdom. That's indicative of heavenly wisdom. What's the opposite of that? Earthly wisdom, right? And what's that earthly wisdom like?
Cultural.
Okay. It's the way that the world operates, for sure. What does he specifically mention in there? Okay, right. There are two things. Bitter jealousy, selfish ambition. Those things drive earthly wisdom, right? We looked at the judges. Everybody did what?
What was right in his own eyes.
Because what's right in my eyes is what I want to do, and that's what I'm going to do. And that causes the wickedness that this world will produce in us if we take that same mindset, that earthly mindset, right? Chapter 4. What did we see in chapter 4 just recently?
Well, that's the question. Where does wars come from within you?
Mm-hmm.
And then it kind of gives us the description of why this war is taking place within us.
Right, right. And it goes back to a lot of those same sentiments that we see at the end of chapter 3, right? It's the selfish desires. It's those it's the desire to be a friend with the world, right? And that's in contrast to the wisdom that is from above. And that friendship with the world causes what?
Enmity
with God. You have put yourself in opposition to the Heavenly Father when we do that, right? And then what's at the end of chapter 4?
Boasting about tomorrow.
Okay, boasting about tomorrow, right? And we have this statement of if the Lord wills, right, that we should be not saying these magic words, if the Lord wills, right? But that we should be thinking with that perspective. What is God's will for me to do today and tomorrow? And in recognition that tomorrow, it may not happen the way that I think it's going to happen, because I have far less control than I believe I have And that might be a problem for us in the way that we think, because we think according to those earthly standards sometimes. Plan it out, that's exactly how it's going to happen. That's leaving God out of our lives, and it will lead to disappointment, problems, and it's our own pride that's causing that. Okay, so beginning of chapter 5, this past Sunday, what did we talk about?
Talking about hoarding,
right? Hoarding up riches, right? Storing up riches for yourself. Is it spoken about in a good way?
No.
It's very, very negative. What kinds of things are being mentioned here about those who are rich? Is how chapter 5, verse 1, come now, you rich. What kind of things were they doing? Okay, they were cheating their workers. Right. What else?
A lot of luxury.
Right. The thing I am placing the emphasis on what's here in this world, and as such, I will live the best that I possibly can in this world, and that may be, as verse 6 says, to the detriment of the righteous man. Right. And I do think that these first 6 verses is not specifically, hey, I know you churches out there full of scattered Jewish Christians that you're all a bunch of rich people. I don't think really that's what's being stated here. I think one of the things that he's saying is don't try and be a rich person. That's not the goal in life, is to go out and be somebody who is rich, because we see that when that attitude is taken, that desire is had, these kinds of actions take place. And those things that you work so hard for and think are so important, your gold and your silver have rusted. There'll be a witness against you and consume your flesh like fire. It is in the last days that you have stored up your treasure. And following verse 6, where it says, you have condemned, and he's speaking to the rich again there, you have condemned and put to death the righteous man. He does not resist you. He starts this section, verse 7 through 12. So if someone would please read off the screen up here, verses 7 through 12, for us to get started this evening.
Therefore, be patient, brethren, until the coming of the Lord. The farmer waits for the freshest produce of the soil, being patient about it, until it gets the early and late rains. You too be patient, strengthen your hearts, for the coming of the Lord is near. Do not complain, brethren, against one another, so that you yourselves may not be judged. Behold, the judge is standing right at the door. As an example, brethren, of suffering and patience, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord. Recount those blessed who endured. You have heard of the endurance of Job and have seen the outcome of the Lord's dealings, that the Lord is full of compassion and is merciful. But above all, my brethren, do not swear either by heaven or by earth or with any other oath, but your yes is to be yes and your no, no, so that you may not fall under judgment.
Okay, so let's start with just this first statement here. Therefore, be patient, brethren, until the coming of the Lord. So what do you notice at the very beginning of the verse there?
Therefore.
And what's the rule about saying therefore? You have to look before it to see what it's there for. Right? It is a continuation of a thought that has already been given. So what was given previously, or previous to verse 7 here? Okay, the misuse of riches. So how does that apply to therefore be patient, brethren?
I want to be rich, and instead of being patient in your trials and your everyday life,
mm-hmm.
persevering in the Lord, persevering and trusting in God, mm-hmm. until the day he comes back. Because our ultimate reward is heaven. That's our ultimate riches.
Right, and we could have a temptation while on this earth and while dealing with trials that he talks about in chapter 1 to say, this is just hard. And these other people around me, they're rich. And I would really just prefer to be doing what they are doing. However it is that you get to that, that would be my preference. Who is he speaking to here in verse 7?
The
brethren. Okay? Now, he started chapter 5, verse 1, and he says, you rich. And then he says, be patient, brethren. And I wonder if there's a little bit of a separation that's being drawn here. Because in verse 6, it says that these rich have condemned and put to death the righteous man, and he does not resist you. And then he turns to his brethren and says, be patient until the coming of the Lord. I wonder if they're being persecuted by those who are rich. They're being persecuted by those who have a higher position than them.
I wouldn't discount that, but he's talking to brethren, all of us, including the rich.
Mm-hmm.
And he's making a point that's made throughout a lot of the Bible. And we got to think about that, because in this country, we are rich.
Mm-hmm.
It's real easy to forget that mm-hmm. comes from God. And it's a pretty sobering warning to brethren.
Right. I think that clearly the warnings that he gives here, like you mentioned, if we look at everybody in this room, the consideration will be that we're rich, right? And so those warnings are clearly a problem for it can be an issue for every one of us. Jen?
Well, this thought occurred to me. He's been making needed hard. And said to them about their riches. And it seems to me like this is kind of almost like an affectionate thing to remind them.
Mm-hmm.
He still knows their brethren.
Right.
And he loves his own life. Mm-hmm. And we're talking to somebody mm-hmm. called by name in the midst of what we're doing, or sister or brother.
Right. Right.
He said some hard things.
He has. I just keep going back to it seems to be two very different things that he's saying in these two groups. In the first one, he says, you are condemning and putting to death the righteous man, right? That seems very different than brethren continue on the path that you're on. Like I see kind of that separation being brought between the two things there. And maybe I'm overstating that. I think he's, at a minimum, what we see is that he's saying, look, you're enduring difficult times. Whether it be because you're torn by desiring to be the rich man, or you're torn by the desires that come from being a rich man, whatever it is, he says that you must endure in what you're doing in the Lord. That's the responsibility of the person here, is to endure in what they're doing in the Lord, right? And so he says, brethren, be patient. Be patient. It says, until the coming of the Lord. Look, I'm going to tell you, this class and the next class, I am probably least comfortable with out of all of the classes, just so you know. So I'm going to ask some questions just to get some ideas about some things that are going on. Because in this text, he mentions multiple times the coming of the Lord. He talks about the coming of the Lord is near. He talks about the judge is standing right at the door, right? These seem to be very, very like, hey, look up, look up, look up. Even going back to verse 4 where he says, come now, you don't even know if tomorrow is there, right? You don't even know if you have tomorrow, right? So this idea of the coming of the Lord, how do we look at that? How do we view that? Dave?
Yeah, I think it's interesting that, what was it, Peter who said that some people were saying, well, where is the Lord's return? He's not going to come back. Everything keeps happening the same as it always has.
Mm-hmm.
He says, but with the Lord, a day is as a thousand years, and a thousand years is as a day.
Mm-hmm.
So it is kind of interesting to me that the word soon is mentioned a lot, when that could mean 2,000 years from now.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, what was that, 400 years between the Old and New Testament?
Right, you have the years of silence between the two.
Mm-hmm. We're waiting and waiting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We've been waiting 2,000 years for him to come back. But the God, it was 2 days ago that his son rose from the dead.
Right. So that is one thought, is to say, look, when we talk about that, when we talk about the second coming of the Lord, right, that's what we're talking about, right? If we were to think about the second coming of the Lord, it's near. It's, you know, because God doesn't view time as either this massive expanse or this very little short period of time. So that's one way of looking at it, to say, okay, with God, time is just a construct of man's mind. He works within his own time to accomplish things.
Our breath of life, like we have our extended life,
right,
the coming of our life. Our death will be meeting God, and in his judgment,
right,
that coming of the Lord.
Right. I think in a minimum, we have to see that in everything that we see here. Like the day of the Lord means a lot of things when you look through the text. But it always means judgment. It always means judgment. God brings some kind of judgment on some group of people, some individual, whatever it may be, right? And our day of the Lord may be my death. There will be judgment at the end of my life. And so I have to be sober-minded about that in everything that I do. And I have to take these things to heart, knowing that my days are not long. And it could be concluded at any point in time. Sam?
Christians used to view the coming of the Lord as imminent.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, in fact, Paul had to deal with a group of Christians who weren't working because they thought it was that far away. We tend to think it's been 2,000 years, so we've probably got another 1,000 years.
Right.
We tend to view ourselves as in the middle of the timeline.
Uh-huh.
It could be in the next 20 seconds.
Right.
We really don't know. But you know, I almost wonder if we've lost our sense of that urgency.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it should always be there. It should always be there because we don't have any guarantees about the time that we have on this earth, whether it be our death or the coming of Christ. We don't. And to,
also, matches with the rich man and Lazarus.
Right.
That story is there for a
reason. Yeah, the rich man continued to live his life without thinking there would be any issue, right? And both of them, their debts were, or they were judged. And that's another thing. We mentioned judgment multiple times throughout. And we often think when we hear judgment, like, that's just God condemning the wicked people. But a righteous judge separates righteous and wicked. And those that are righteous will be exalted. So I think we have to be very careful, too, when we think about judgment, that we don't immediately go, it's just condemnation for all sorts of people. It's really God separating the righteous and the unrighteous and exalting the righteous and bring condemnation on those that he said he would condemn because of the actions that they took. Yeah.
I think it's also worth noting that these words have to speak to them in that time,
mm-hmm.
speak to us right now,
mm-hmm.
and then who knows if the world is still around in 1,000 years, it has to speak to those people in 1,000 years, or
mm-hmm.
it has to speak to the people who the Lord is going to come in their lifetime. Just as it speaks to us.
Mm-hmm.
So it has to, you know, these words are, they have to be timeless.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, you can't say, oh, well, for you, it's not going to happen in your lifetime. You know, because it doesn't work that way.
So right.
You have to, like, view it in the sense that it has to be applicable to everyone across all time.
Mm-hmm.
So it does put a lot of emphasis on the fact that, you know, your life is but a breath, you know, in
mm-hmm.
the wind, because it may not apply to, you know, I may get to live my entire lifetime, you know, my own, however long, but, you know, the person that I'm trying to reach out to may not.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have to view it as there are other people around us that we have a responsibility of trying to reach mm-hmm. that may not have that kind of time that we are allotted.
Right.
So we just don't know. So it's very, like, all-encompassing
mm-hmm.
the verse.
When Jesus speaks, it's with urgency. Whenever you read throughout the text, he doesn't tell anybody to, you know, wait to obey his words. He doesn't tell anybody, you know, it's okay, there will be time. If you read through Mark, just the actions of Jesus would suggest do it immediately. There is an immediacy that Jesus asks us to act with. We have no assurances of a continuation of time. And so I think as we read through this, that idea of we shouldn't forget that the coming of the Lord is imminent. Right? That should be our mentality always. And I think sometimes we just think, well, the Lord's probably not going to come in my life. I think that's been stated a couple of times that people have this mentality. Your life will still end. Right? It's guaranteed. And you don't know when that is. So from either one of those perspectives, the attitude should be that I need to be acting on these things now, knowing that I don't have any assurance.
Well, in the contrast in these verses we're looking at now, when he's counseling us to be patient,
mm-hmm.
even going back to the farmer, he's not telling the farmer to wait to plant the seed.
Right.
Okay, you plant that seed mm-hmm. immediately, but now you have to wait through, you know, through the trials you have.
Right.
So there's
right.
there's both the sense of urgency and mm-hmm. the sense of patience.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, you need to get right with God, but then you need to understand that there's going to be things you have to endure.
Right.
That's, I think, what this lesson on patience.
Right, right. And whenever it says be patient, it says be patient with an eye on the Lord. It's not be patient and just like, just deal with it and eventually things will probably work out.
Or get right with God someday in the future.
Right. It's be patient knowing that God is the one that's functioning in all of this. So
time is so relative.
Mm-hmm.
A child says, I can't wait for my birthday. And it's going to be 2 weeks off. We say, oh, it's not going to be long. It's going to be long. To him, it's half a lifetime almost, as he views it.
Uh-huh.
And it's not going to be long until the Lord comes.
Mm-hmm.
To us, it may seem long.
Mm-hmm.
But the older we get, the shorter it seems.
Right.
And it's appointed a man wants to die and then the judgment.
Mm-hmm.
And it's right on us.
Mm-hmm.
And he wants us to realize that urgency.
Mm-hmm.
And he's talking to people who may very well have had some envy of those rich people.
Mm-hmm.
Look how, we'll just wait. It's just not going to be long.
Right.
Because you're going to get your reward,
mm-hmm.
which they will lose.
Mm-hmm.
So just wait a little longer.
Right.
Verse 10 also has the example of the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord. It says, this is your example. And it makes me think, you know, some of the prophets in the Old Testament knew that, you know, they were not, like, justice was not going to be served in their lifetime.
Right.
But they were still tasked with, you know, being a prophet mm-hmm. and the voice of God while they were there.
Right.
So it may not happen in our lifetime,
mm-hmm.
even though we may want it to. It may not, but we still have tasks that God has given us to do, whether or not it does.
Yeah. I think about this, and I'm not going to attribute this to what's being said here necessarily. Mm-hmm. There's about to be a judgment on Jerusalem coming up here as well. For a lot of people that claim to be of God that were not of God. They weren't acting in God's on God's behalf to do what was right, to be pleasing to him. And that was a day of the Lord that was coming, and it was going to bring judgment on those people. There were also instructions for those that listened to Jesus about leaving the city and listening to or knowing the signs and knowing what to do if you're following after the words of Christ. That is a day of the Lord. It's an example of the day of the Lord that was soon to come. And if the people weren't aware, if they weren't realizing and thinking in Jerusalem, then they could have been caught up in the chief priests and the scribes and the Pharisees that were all about looking good in front of men. And during the destruction of Jerusalem, they would have been swept up and destroyed in a day of judgment from the Lord in which they didn't even see coming.
I think one thing we haven't touched on is beyond just the patience and the endurance part of it. We bring out two rewards that I think probably far less to grasp what they are. But in an industrialized agricultural society where we can like program it whatever we want,
right.
the precious produce of the soil,
mm-hmm.
I really can't grasp what that would be like
mm-hmm.
for a farmer who mm-hmm. had none of today's technology to do that.
Right.
Likewise, he brings up Job, says you have heard of the endurance of Job and have seen the outcome of the Lord's dealings. Well, for Job, that was ultimately twice as much mm-hmm. of his already
big estate.
Right.
So he comes out of this thing where these people are cheating people and trying, probably not doubling what they had based on this cheat.
Right.
But trying to take a shortcut to something.
Mm-hmm.
And he's saying, wait, because whatever's coming is way better.
Right. We talked earlier in the class about the idea of exalting your own self. And there are two choices that you can have. When you exalt yourself, you look good in front of men. And that exaltation is really pretty low. But if you're willing to humble yourself before the Lord and let the Lord give you that exaltation is far superior than anything any man is going to bestow on you in your own pride. It's just not going to compare whatsoever. It's also... the timing of each one of those is significantly different. You can be exalted here in this life for a very short period of time, or God can put you in his house for eternity and call you his child. Those exaltations are very different. And yet, the temptation is to see the exaltation in front of us and take it, to not have the patience or the endurance to be able to go to the end, running our race with the faith that the Lord commands of us. We've mentioned some of these examples already. The farmer waits, right, for the precious produce of the soil. That's the end goal. That's the desire. And anybody that's grown their own tomatoes knows they are infinitely better than anything you could buy at Kroger or any other grocery store. And I'm serious. It's true. I have also seen a green tomato come on a tomato plant and just thought, oh, soon I'm going to be able to eat that tomato. Soon. It's going to happen. And after it didn't turn red for a long time, I went online and said, how long does it take Better Boy tomatoes to turn red after you get a green one on the plant? 60 days. Oh, 60 days. Man, my patience was, it was hard. It was hard. I want a red tomato. I want a red tomato. I couldn't change that process. I had no way of speeding it up. You know, they've got all those tips and tricks online, none of which work. I wanted it, but I had to wait for the process to go through until I could finally get that ripe red tomato that was so delicious.
That's what patience.
Right. It must come with patience, because otherwise I would have stopped doing the daily things that I needed to do to keep up those tomatoes. You know, you let them get overgrown, and then they break the cage, and then they fall down, and then worms get in them, and then you don't have any produce. You've lost everything, and the small amount of work that you did put in was for nothing. So this idea of the early and the late rains, the farmer's still doing things while that's going on. He's still weeding. He's still going out and checking to make sure there are no bugs that are getting into his crops. He's doing all those things daily. That's work that's being put in. But he's waiting on the Lord to reap the produce at the end. Right? We are in a life where God has told us we have work to do. We have an attitude that we have to have. We have a life that we are supposed to live. And it may seem like things just aren't going right all around us all the time. But we're maybe only seeing our portion of it. And we're not thinking about, I must be patient. Until God, who we've heard about the kind of God he is because we've read the story of Job, he is full of compassion and merciful. And if I will have patience, not with an eye towards myself, but with an eye towards God, I will reap the benefit of the precious produce of the soil that is promised through him. So this idea of being a farmer is not just plant it, and then, you know, water will come at certain times and then it comes up. There's actions to be taken during that. There's work that's being done during that. But it's still a complete reliance on God that the final produce will be given at the right time. When it talks about the prophets who not just were patient, but suffered in their patience. Does anybody have an example of any prophets that suffered in patience? Say what?
Hebrews 11.
So, right, there's a whole list of people that in their faith struggled because of the wickedness that was around them. Hosea, right? Jeremiah. Ezekiel. What about Elijah? Right? Oh, sorry, I didn't hear you. How did I not hear? I heard Janice, and I didn't hear you. You must not have been talking very loud. Elijah. To me, Elijah is a great example. I continually go back to Daniel just because I just came out of a Daniel class. But Daniel prophesied about things that were hundreds of years down the road that was going to bring destruction on nations that were wicked and oppressed God's people. He continued to speak those things even though he lived his life in captivity. He lived his life under foreign rule in a place where they made him speak a different language and did everything that they could to turn him into somebody from their own nation. But in what he did, he was true to God in that he would not be disobedient to his word. And he followed him. And he continued to speak the words that God put in his mouth. I think that's what's being spoken of here when it talks about the prophets as an example. It's not just that they endured while saying things that caused them to have to endure more difficult things, right? That's the example of the prophets. We are going to have to say things in this life that's going to make it more difficult than it already is because we're speaking the words of God. We're speaking the words that are either going to change people's hearts or turn them against us in many ways. And that's the example of the prophets who suffered. And if we were to go back to the Sermon on the Mount, which we pulled from multiple times looking throughout James, what does Jesus say about persecution in Matthew chapter 5? Blessed are you, right? When they insult you and persecute you and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me, rejoice and be glad, for your reward is great in heaven. For in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you, right? They persecuted them not because they just didn't like them. They persecuted them because of the words that they spoke for the Lord. And we will be persecuted for the same thing. If we are bold enough to speak it and to live it each and every day of our life. And that will be different for everyone. Not everyone suffers in the same way because of their life for Christ. So I had a great lesson on that the other day about would it be worth it if I dealt daily with the kind of struggles that Paul did. Right? And the answer is yes. You can go back and listen to the lesson if you want a more clear answer than that. But we will receive those persecutions just like the prophets did, but in patience they suffered, knowing that some of the prophecies that they gave that would bring justice on the wicked, they would never see. They would never have an understanding of in the life that they lived here on this earth. And then the last example there being the endurance of Job. Right. How did Job endure? Right. So at one point his wife says, just curse God and die. Right. This is the only thing you have nothing. This is the only thing that you're holding on to. And Job would not do it. Now, Job said some things to God that I think later he said, I should not have said those things, which is why whenever God speaks to him, he goes, like God says, who are you who darkens counsel without wisdom? I think is what he says. Job, you don't know what you're talking about, right? But did Job turn to the world in his time of difficulty?
He actually resisted the counsel of his friends.
Right, right. To just say, well, I guess I am. I guess I'm not righteous before God. He could have very easily at any point just said, God is just a mean kid on an anthill with a magnifying glass, and I'm done with this. I'm done with this. Job continually seeks God out. Some of the things he says, I don't think they were good things to say. I don't think they were the right thing to say. But he always knew that the source was God. And he continued to go back to God and go back to God. And do you know what Job's greatest fear was before God? It wasn't that God was going to take something else of his away. It wasn't his fleshly condition before God. He wants to know, is God there? And why does God think he's not righteous? That's the concern that Job has, right? that's a perspective of endurance that is difficult for me. Job endures everything that he has, and continually all he does is go back to God, back to God, back to God. My friends are saying things. Those things aren't right. I know God's the one that's got the answer. God, answer me. Answer me, God. Answer me, God. And God answers him. And it's not even the answer that I think he was looking for. But it was sufficient because he knew God was there and he knew God saw him.
As far as we know, he never knew why that happened.
Right.
Because, you know, we don't always know why things happen to us. He didn't either.
Right. Yeah, we don't get any indication that God says, well, Job, see, Satan was wandering around and we had this, like, battle of the bests or something like that. That's never told. That's never told. Didn't need to be told, honestly. Job knew that God saw him. And it says that the Lord is full of compassion and is merciful. Job answered God. In his time, he answered God. I'm sorry, God answered Job in his time. He answered Job. And he blessed Job. That idea of what he had before and then what he had after, I heard somebody making the statement of the early and the late rains. Right? The early rain, actually, in the way that it's spoken here, would be that's when the seed goes in the ground and it germinates. You get the early rains. And the late rains is when the crop is really produced. So everybody's excited when the early rain comes on because the seed has germinated and we start to see little plants come up.
You rain like water?
Like, yeah. And then the great excitement is in the late rains when we know it's time to reap the produce, right? Okay, any thoughts on the examples that are given here? We're actually going to look at some of the warnings that are mentioned in here as well. But any other thoughts on the examples that are given here? All right. So a couple of warnings that are in here, kind of interspersed in between. Verse 9, do not complain, brethren, against one another, right? So that you yourselves may not be judged. Behold, the judge is standing right at the door. Why is this in here? Why is it just kind of throw in this, do not complain against one another?
Well, Ryan, I mean, I was leaning towards, because he was talking about it, basically in chapter 4, verse 11.
Mm-hmm.
I wondered if it could be a follow-up thought. In chapter 4, verse 11, he was talking about not speaking evil against your brethren.
Right.
Or judging your brethren.
Mm-hmm.
That hypocritical judgment.
Right.
So I didn't know if this could be a follow-up of that same thought.
It could be. I didn't connect those two. That's really good. It seems like their personal relationships with one another as brethren are not the best, right? Remember, they're still viewing each other with those earthly eyes where they look at somebody and they show partiality based on maybe outward appearance or economic status or judgment that is not because of the actions that they're doing that are right or wrong, but instead a judgment based on earthly appearance. So
they may have been going through a pandemic.
Uh-huh. They may have. That seems to bring out complaints, doesn't it?
People get crossed up with each other to a degree that mm-hmm. is not normal.
Right. In suffering, is it a lot easier to have bad attitudes towards one another? I think it's clearly easier to complain against my brother and to talk against my brother, to be short with my brother. I know what happens in our house when we haven't had enough sleep or we haven't eaten yet. Or we've had a bad day, right? Like, we have to restrain ourselves from complaining against one another whenever we deal with trials. And we're promised we will have trials in this life. And so if we know we're going to have trials, something we know we're going to have to look out for is that when we're in the midst of difficulty, we get upset with our brethren. Not for good reason. Not righteous indignation like sometimes we think we have. But because, well, I'm having a difficult time, and you know what? You're contributing to it. If you just saw things from my perspective, let's take the pandemic approach here. If you just saw things from my perspective, then everything would be better. You know, what's wrong with you? Why don't you have this attitude? Why don't you have that attitude? And we complain against our brother. We are angry with our brother. And it's Or our children, right, right, yeah. It is, it is. It's definitely something, hey, look, I totally understand. But whenever we are dealing with the difficulties that require patience with us, part of that patience is going to continue to view my brother the same way as when things are going well. I can't change that.
Remember the synagogues, the Gentiles that wanted to hear, had to stand outside the synagogue and look through.
Mm-hmm.
All right, now they've got to unite.
Right.
And that was a separation that had extended for centuries and centuries.
Mm-hmm.
And now they have to get along.
Mm-hmm. Right. And there's clearly going to be difficulty because the world around them still views Jews and Gentiles as like, no, these are two separate things. And only recently has Christ broken down the wall that says, no, you are all made in God's image and have the same place in my body. And so when things get rough, find somebody to complain about, find somebody to blame it on. And it's very easy whenever the rest of the world around them is still drawing that divide between the two of them very clearly. Okay, let's go ahead and jump down to verse 12 so we can get this in as well, and then we'll pick up in verse 13 starting next time. He says, "But above all, my brethren, do not swear either by heaven or by earth or with any other oath, but your yes is to be yes and your no, so that you may not fall under judgment." Okay? So why is he telling them not to swear or to have this oath or give an oath?
Sounds like the Sermon on the Mount.
Right? So what specifically?
The Jews would swear by different parts of the temple, or depending on how much they wanted you to believe.
Right. Right. So it's like, if you swear by the temple, you don't really have to keep that promise. But if you swear by the gold of the temple, then you have to keep that promise, right? What's the problem with that idea of some things you swear an oath about and some things you don't?
You should be trusted enough to say, yes, you should. I don't have a concern when that is great.
Right. Exactly. Everybody's going to question when you don't swear if the only time you're telling the truth is when you do swear. As Christians, as people that are supposed to be seen, especially by those of the world, and while they would try to find something against us, not be able to find something against us, it's going to require us to hold true to our yes and to our no. Our words should be iron. They should be locked in whenever we speak them. We don't speak them with the intention of, well, I'll figure out a way to get out of this later. Right?
Because he says, above all, my brothers,
mm-hmm.
he says not to lie to one another because we're part of each other.
Right.
So,
right.
And, we're not here, but.
Yeah, I think in particular they should be able to trust each other just as we should be able to trust each other as well. The world as a whole doesn't view your word as a very important. I see it in business all the time that people just say, yeah, I'll get this or I'll do that, and just never actually fulfill it. And it's become an expectation that people won't keep their word. A group of people that always keeps their word would stand out significantly in a world where that just doesn't seem to be true. Glenn?
Well, kind of related to that, when I teach a high school class, I tell them, don't misuse your language.
Mm-hmm.
Because it cheapens it.
Right.
Then what you say becomes less important,
mm-hmm.
or holds less weight.
Mm-hmm.
And so take what you say, because it seems to be that teenage age is when they just let things fly.
Right.
Be careful with what you're talking about.
Right. And in particular, sometimes we may be wanting to do good. And so we say, yes, I'll do this, or yes, I'll do that, or no, I won't do this, or no, I won't do that, without thinking about it. And this is saying your words actually hold a lot of weight. Sometimes you need to stop and think before you commit to something or before you agree to something. Just really quickly, with the kids, if we say, if we make a rule, we as parents have to hold to that rule. So if I say, if you do this, you are going to receive this punishment, then that is what will happen, right? We had to realize very early on, we had to be very careful with making those rules, because we knew if we were going to be consistent so that they understood what yes and no was, then we were going to have to be very careful about drawing those hard lines in the sand. And so we had to consider what we could make our yes be yes and we could make our no be no with. And I think that God says, as my people, you should be different from the rest of the world, and that you see that you hold to your word. Ms. Katie?
Your word should be your bond.
Right.
What you live by.
Right.
Your example.
Mm-hmm. And people shouldn't have to.
If you don't have a good example, your word mm-hmm.
Right. And people shouldn't have to question us.
Right.
It's whenever we say something, it's like, well, it's probably not going to happen because, you know, Ryan never comes through in any of his promises. Right. Very good. Very good. Yeah. He had a lot of very practical points on being a trustworthy person. And there are things that are just how building your reputation as somebody that does what you say you're going to do. And maybe you say yes, and some circumstance comes up and you can't follow through with something. You go to the person and say immediately, you're not going to find out a week after I was supposed to have it done, I just didn't do it. You're going to say, look, this is what came up. This is what I'm going to do to try and fix it or to rectify and move forward in that direction. I thought those are some really good practical messages that he gave for us to make our yes, yes, and our no, no. And for everybody that was around us to understand that of us. Janice, did you have a...
We are children of truth.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. So let your yes be yes and your no be no. Anyways, thank you for your comments and helping me work through those verses there. There are lessons on the back seat back there if you'd like to pick one up for the next class. Oh, yeah, thanks. Stop sharing the screen, too. I don't know who wants. I don't know where. There we go. And